time this morning. This is like shocking to me. Great morning already. Good crisp morning. His food. And Lanier has been a go-to guy for this church for many, many years. You may or may not know when we went through some changes at our church 25 years ago, Lanier stepped in and took the podium and was a preacher for us for a while. He's been leading and teaching the Brian class for I don't know how long. We had Don Campbell, president of DTS, leading it for a while, and then Lanier's been leading the Brian class. Professor of theology at DTS. Kathy has been every bit as involved at our church as Lanier has been. Matter of fact, if you ever go to a funeral here, she's the volunteer leader for all the gals that help with the funeral. So we are very much indebted to the Burns family. He's been here at our church since 1980, and just a great wealth of knowledge. So come on up, Lanier. Welcome, Lanier.
You might pray for me this morning. We had the privilege of having out-of-town guests in the past week, and they arrived in fine form saying we brought some wonderful gifts to you. And so the gifts were presented, but the gift that they brought was not covered, and that was bronchitis and virus. So it's nothing like having hospitality and coming down with a wonderful gift.
Sharing is caring.
And so my prayer this morning when I woke up was, Lord, help me not to get into a coughing fit. And that'll be great. So pray with me if you would, and I'll begin the presentation. Dear Lord, we come to you. We thank you for concerned men for Jesus Christ, who are staunch disciples and want to serve you. And want their lives to count for you. Help the things that are shared this morning to be helpful and a blessing to all. Amen. Can everyone hear me in the back? Okay. I did read the web page. I'm retired now. I'm 81 years old. And so I discovered that the theme of the breakfast is men of courage. And I don't normally think of life in that way, but the more I thought about it, the more I realized that while I haven't thought about courage, courage is the issue for most men. And so I think the theme is well taken. And that it continued with the fact that courage is a problem because we're afraid. And men don't admit they're afraid. But it said we fear rejection. It said we fear that we won't have the answers, or I would maybe say fear of the unknown, because the unknown takes control away from you. And thirdly, the fear of submitting to worldly pressure, and it's formidable. It is formidable. Most people have little idea. So I've spent quite a bit of time thinking about this. I was supposed to come in October, and we were out of town. And what I have to tell you came out of one of the last years I had teaching at Dallas Seminary. I was teaching advanced theology. And the students said, could you devote some time to explain to us what the Lord has done in your life? I said, I'd be delighted to. Well, that was 4 weeks. But I don't have 4 weeks. And we had discussion and we talked. And that's the way I work best. I'm not terribly fond of speeches, of sermons, of formal presentations. I'd much rather be among a group of fellas just talking and sharing real life. Because after you've been in ministry for 50 years, as I have, you can hype ministry just like you can hype Monday night football or Thursday night football or I mean, I'm tired of hype at 81. Just give it to me straight, all right? It's never as big as they make it out to be. So I have reduced what I did in 4 weeks down to 5 points. I could have brought PowerPoints, but that way you get into a memory exercise, and some things I say for you might click and others might not. But I took 5 points that have helped me with the problem of courage and my fears in life. I have not included 3 major areas of my life, and you might as well know what they are. Academia. I spent 41 years as a professor. I finished, retired last year, distinguished professor. I spent 20 years of my adult life in doctoral research, earned 2 of them. And brain science, 30 years of my life I gave to brain science. And I gave it to brain science because it's the only way I can relate to my culture. And between the church and the culture, there is an immense gap. An immense gap. In fact, one man who attended our church for a couple of weeks or 3 weeks, eminent doctor, involved at Southwestern Medical Center, he came up to me after church and he said, Lanier, he said, you know, of course, I had read his work at DTS. He wanted to write a little something there. And he said, you know, of course, that people I affiliate with don't agree with more than 2% of what's said here. I said, I'm well aware of that. I'll tell you the secret, they're not easy. And people don't particularly care about what we think until we care about what they think. So when I go to university campuses, and I've been to most, and I go into brain labs, I begin with an appreciation for the senior researcher that I'm talking to. And I haven't had a single one to say, leave my office. They're lonely people. And they want Christ, but they just don't know it. But I've been told 1,000 times, since you know what you're talking about, come on in the lab and let's show you what we're doing. And that has been immensely helpful. I can't dwell on anything this morning, but let me say that the church has really neglected biology and the body. And it's neglected it because it gets us in trouble. We like to think about the soul, but that's a misnomer because it's a misuse of the way the word has been used, except in classical literature. And we avoid the body because, came from Plato, from Catholic Church, body is evil, right? Matter is evil. So you got to jump right in because Paul says, therefore, my beloved brethren, by the mercies of God, present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable, which is your reasonable service. So academia, that's all. The other is revolutions. I was born in 43. I'm a war baby. Every one of my years has been filled with controversies. Now, yours has too. But I'm convinced after graduate study, you don't realize how revolutionary your context has been. It's very disorienting. Demographics, sexual, right, you bet. Technological. Anybody here remember Y2K? The whole world was coming apart. We're a world at war, always have been. War is a constant. So revolutions. Number 3, sports. And I'm a sports nut. I always have been. High school and college, I was a wrestler. And I played racket sports and golf with my dad. And I still am a sports fan, but I don't get caught up in it. And that's a wonderful thing for me. So here goes my 5 points and how they've contributed to me. Number 1. My family, number 1. I had a wonderful mom and dad. Dad had me when he was 50 years old. Mom was 39. So I was really raised by grandparents. And they did not like my grade at school. And I've come to the conclusion after years of evaluation that they're right. I mean, I was always lived my life before seminary amongst hellions. And it was a very liberal education. But Mom and Dad invested a lot in me, and I in them. I'm one of four siblings. I have two brothers and a sister. But I'm the one who latched on to Dad and Mom and milked them. Farmer who did not graduate from college. Mom was a homemaker who did not graduate from college. Dad had little use for preachers and teachers. Welcome, Lanier, you know. And he had little use. All they know how to do is sit down and have coffee. Do something. You know? So Dad would walk the golf course with me. And the first thing he grilled me on, because he said, preachers are lousy at it, is finances. And we avoid the term, the talking about money, because it's, you know, it's a love of money. It's the root of all evil. But I've never met anybody that didn't love money. So Dad grilled into me how you are accountable with your what the Lord brings, and you never, ever, ever go into debt. He said, if you go into debt, you're going to have a hard time getting out. And I've discovered that applies to a lot of life. I would stay up nights with Mom and Dad, and they liked their Christianity simple. It was, I'm from a deep, deep Presbyterian background, but when I came along, the Presbyterian church was headed straight downhill. Everybody said, please stay in. And as a matter of fact, you can't turn it around. You can't turn it around because the seminaries are rotten. I've had a lot of contact with my peers, with other people, and they were told the same thing and stayed in, and so much of their life went down when it could have counted. So they instilled in me a love of work. In fact, I always remember, I told Dad, Dad, I don't have any money. I need to work. I was a senior in high school. He said, I got a job for you, son. Old man McAmis outside Knoxville, Tennessee, where I was raised, owned a big old farm with no machinery. So I worked from 6 in the morning till 6 at night on 50 cents an hour. I'd go home in the evening, dead tired, and I still wouldn't have any money to spend. I'm married with four children, ages 46 to 55 now, and 11 grandchildren. To my mind, raising a family is the most worthwhile, dignified, beautiful thing that a person can do. It is central to the Bible and rarely taught. Central to the Bible. Kathy and I have been married 58 years. Things I've learned through the family are faithfulness and responsibility. I wish I could elaborate, but honestly, I have no idea how I got my kids through college and gave them a wedding. I'm just looking in wonder at that at 81. So everybody says, how'd you get your kids through college on a minister's salary? I said, I don't know. That's the answer. And I said, there was a bank somewhere. Robin, you ever heard of Key Bank? Sure. So, you know, Key Bank said, look, send us a little money and we'll make sure your kid gets through college. So that's what I did. I never saw a bill, and they graduated, married, and have wonderful grandchildren. Tomorrow I'll go to St. Mark's to be with my grandson for his open house. The thing that came down on me as a father and as a husband was, I don't think people get this, how hard it is to provide for your family. People take a job and work for granted. But folks, I nearly broke my back trying to take care of my family, and it came from Mom and Dad. And the responsibility, my son was born with a congenital problem, so we spent 15 years in the hospital. But my family was so important, and I didn't use the word courage with it, but I was just too doggone busy to be afraid. When I stopped and took a little time off, I'm saying, what in the world is going on? I got to get out of here. But then somebody else would call on me and need me. In fact, I was so busy, I was driving down Interstate 35, and I had a heart attack. A moderate heart attack, according to my cardiologist. Any of y'all have a moderate heart attack? I couldn't stop. I just had to keep going because class started in 10 minutes. So I went to class, taught, and kept going. Of course, I got AFib off of that, which is hardly a prize, but that's neither here nor there. So the thing I get out of family is the most important commitment. And I was afraid to fail, I'll be honest with you. And you just got to take it by the day. Number two, military. I spent 12 years in the military. 12 years. Is that a basic commitment? Yeah. Because I went to a military high school, preparatory school. And I was an ROTC. I commanded 1,000 troops in college. I went to Fort Bragg for a basic training. I was commander of 20,000 troops at Fort Bragg. And then they asked what branch you're going into. And Dad said, don't you be a chaplain. Wow, I've got chaplain brothers-in-law. I've got to be careful how I talk. He said, you go front line so that you can understand what men have to face. And I've discovered that Dad's advice is good because I've discovered that 99% of my peers have no idea of what life outside a Christian bubble looks like. They just don't know. And man, it's rough. It's rough. I served in infantry, military police. Military police. Why are you military police? Because I was a little kid and I had to do a black belt in judo on the wrestling team as well. But I was infantry, military, police, and it was, in retrospect, it was one of the most valuable things I did. Why? Because nothing teaches you personal discipline like the military. Yeah, you're scared to death. I mean, you've got to have somebody just walking behind you to clean up the mess you're making as you walk along, okay? You're going through situations. I didn't go to Vietnam, but the military police was in charge of Saigon because I served from 66 to 69. And so while I was in the military police, the navigators got a hold of me. And that's one of the great experiences that I've had in life, and it profoundly affected me. A sergeant major and a businessman took me aside and said, understand you want to walk with the Lord. And I wanted to in the worst sort of way because I was born again at 13 years old. And they said, well, we're going to start a ministry at Fort Sam Houston. I was commander of the company and like for you to join us. And I said, well, I'm busy. And so this sergeant major had the gall to tell me, a commissioned officer, the train's leaving. Either you get on or not. So I got on. Now that's where I learned discipleship. And that's what I've carried all the way through life. I went forward three or four times at Billy Graham Crusades because I didn't want to go to hell. Okay? But it was the navigators who got me on the road. And I just have so many stories from the navs. But it's discipline. It's discipleship. I don't have a lot of fear these days. I've always had around me a circle of men. I met with some men at DTS for 15 years, and they're now faculty members. This is where I have seen real substantial change happen because a man can formulate a talk, and it's over, just like me right now, and I'll go back home and go back to bed, right? Okay. But the military taught me something that most of my peers don't know, and that is you got to know your enemy. We spent a lot of time in the MPs talking about who the enemy was. And people don't like to talk about the enemy, but it is a fearsome thing for a Christian man. The world, the flesh, and the devil. And what people don't realize is that the flesh is the most powerful of the three, and that's inside of you, and you are your own worst enemy. So when the devil works, he plays on your strengths, because that's where you're proud. That's where you feel least vulnerable. Not on your weaknesses, on your strengths. And the world comes at you because that's where your talents lie. But the world is beating you to death, and the part of the world that I chose to study to understand these things is elite education. And so it made me really equipped to understand the political trends of recent times. Know your enemy. The greatest decision, one of them, other than marrying my wife and obeying my parents, was my decision to come to Dallas Seminary to make the Bible the center of my life. That was the big one. That was 50 years ago. I decided after graduating from college that education was a big mess and I needed something in my mind to coordinate knowledge. I need to run knowledge through a hub. You don't fly airplanes? You know, they're hubs. This American Airlines hub, right? All these flights come. Now, your brain is built that way. So I needed a hub for your mind, because a chemistry teacher had a hub, and literature teacher had a hub, philosophy teacher had a hub. And, it goes on and on and on. And you end up a confused mess. And somehow, one of the things the Spirit taught me early on was the Bible is your hub. Ad fontes, going to the fount of all good thought. And I'm so grateful for that. I'm so grateful for the seminary because it let me do that. And it's a unusual seminary to let you do that, all right? At Dallas Seminary, you come across 1,000 doctrines. You come every Sunday and you get a different doctrine, a different application. The problem is when you get to September 30th, you forget what September the 1st was about. In other words, you take your pills like you do vitamins, okay? But when you run your life through a hub, it brings everything in coordination with one thing. Everything about my life is focus. Focus on mom and dad, focus on my family, focus on discipline, focus on discipleship. And don't talk to me about the alternatives because I'm not interested. I made commitments long ago. And now we've got a hub of the Bible who is Jesus Christ. I can't tell you how many people accept doctrines apart from the person. Christianity is about being a follower of Christ. And I can't tell you how that has unified my relationship with men around this city who don't go to this church. Am I busy? Yeah, I'm busy at church, very. But other places I'm busy are my neighborhood, because my wife is very active and people love her and they put up with me, okay? And the way I got it, a Christ-centered focus, was John 14-16, which is Christ's upper room discourse or his rabbinic dialogue. It's been called both things. It is a powerful passage. And the world doesn't bother me like it used to, because the world's going to hate you just like it hated me. And so I expected it to. Now, number four, I've been involved with ministry in India for 51 years. In 1973, a man came to my door. I had no idea who he was. And I'm there standing at the door, and he said, I just came by to ask if you would start a seminary with me in India. And I'm 38, young buck, and I had no idea that it would involve my life. But I've gone to India. Asian Christian Academy was a product of that, and a lot of the best friends I have in the world are involved in that. Now, before that, I was raised in a generation, don't get the wrong idea here from what I'm saying, but the people that I was around when I was being raised said this: let's win the world for Christ in this generation. I bought into that. Hook, line, and sinker. What I didn't realize as a younger man was no one's going to win the world, because it's too hard. It's too hostile. You're not going to win the world. You're not even going to make it to other parts of the world. Most of you. For Christ in this generation sounds to me like you're putting your program in place of God's program, which has been going for 2,000 years, and we're still plugging until he returns. But because of this, I don't fear failure. You walk into situations, and India is extremely hostile, as scary as it can be. I could tell stories of spiders and snakes that we keep. I was sharing this ministry in Austin, Texas, and one man came up and played and said, "Don't tell it as it is, otherwise we can't recruit people to go." But you don't want to do what I did, which is go to India and get malaria and dysentery and lose 40 pounds in 2 weeks. But we started with a budget of $2,500 annual. Guess who paid $2,500? And now ACA, a community of 5,000-6,000 people, counting everything, and a multimillion-dollar budget. But we don't pay attention to that. What counts is, are we serving God in a way that brings glory to him far, far from home? Now, I had gone to other mission fields. For example, I went to Haiti with my son in 1988. And we went up in the mountains. And my job was to have evangelistic crusade and to disciple elders in the church. And I presented the gospel and I got stoned. Any of you ever been stoned? It's a marvelous experience. I'm telling you, it's a marvelous experience. But they turned out the lights, rushed me to the pastor's home, and the voodoo people cut the struts of the pastor's home so the roof fell on my son and myself. I'll never forget that, crawling through the straw, you see. But I made up my mind on that trip. I said, I'm going to go to one place in the world, and I'm going to live with that one, and I'm going to know all about it. Now, that means I know a lot about India. And that is a calling card for serving in any country, okay? My final one, and I'm through. I wore myself out. So I've had 5 illnesses in 10 years, 2004 to 14. 3 or 4 of those were terminal. So what are you doing here now? I don't know. I have no idea why I'm here. But one of them, the chaplain at seminary visited me, was holding my hand. He said, "Lanier, you were gone, and they brought you back." But that was DVT. I was clotted all the way up here. I had pulmonary emboli, the whole works, you know. I had 3 or 4 of those illnesses, and that taught me desperate dependence. Yeah, it's fearsome to get that sick, but after you've been that sick, you're not that afraid anymore. What you do when life throws its worst at you is you do it. That's the military. That's life. That's common sense. And you use it to get closer to the Lord. And I can tell you, I've never had one more wonderful prayer than I had in the intensive care facilities and in the various emergency facilities of local hospitals. So, what I'm trying to say is the problem of courage and of fear cannot be solved by one talk or one point. And it's not simple. It's a process. It's a lifelong process. I think I've had a lot of victory over fear. And I've been courageous, but I just didn't know it. I'm not bragging in front of you when I say I survived my upbringing. I survived the military. I survived graduate study. I survived academic hostility. I've survived India. One time I got close to a 14-foot cobra, king cobra, black on top, silver on the bottom. And the little Indian man said, "You want to see the cobra strike?" I said, "Well, you might as well. We're over here, you know, thousands of miles away from home." So he said, 20 rupees, which is about a nickel. It's an 80-to-1 ratio. So he takes a stick and bangs that thing. And I said, "Be careful over there, man." He said, "All right." Old cobra raises up and looks straight at me. straight at me. And I tell you, if that thing bites you, you're going to get a quart of venom. I'm telling you. But anyway, what a cobra does when it's up, told you I knew a lot about India, is it stands there just as long as possible, and then it begins to go down again. So the little man said to me, you want to see a cobra strike? I said, sure. Give him 20 rubies. Second time, bam, old cobra rises. I don't want to meet those folks without the Lord. The world's full of snakes. But, you know, my life, God has made such a way. I'm so thankful, Eddie. It's a process of doing a few things well rather than everything. So I'd like to ask if you have any questions about what I've said. I wish I were down there and we could just sip coffee together. But I'm way up here, lofty and up high, and every one of you looking up. I'm not much to look up to. Of the 5 points, which one was the most challenging? Probably the most challenging was coming to Texas with my brand new wife to enroll at Dallas Theological Seminary. That brought rejection by my family. They resented that strongly, and they let me know it. And the Presbyterian Church went after my family, and they said, he's joining a cult. If you believe the Bible, of course, you're going to be joining a cult, okay? But that was really tough. And we didn't, you know, we had saved a little bit from the military, but we were in a town where we didn't know anybody. And it was 107 degrees. And my wife said, you know, is this going to work out? And I said, I don't know. But it was a terrifying experience. Terrifying. How did I meet her? Yeah, okay. Well, you know, she is from a major city in Tennessee called Sweetwater. It's not Sweetwater, Texas, it's Tennessee. Town of 5,000 people. So she was in college at Tennessee Wesleyan, and my sister was a Sunday school teacher at the Morris Hill Presbyterian Church. And so I was a senior at Davidson College where I attended, and I was just sick of fraternity parties. I'm a Sigma Chi. And I just, you know, it was Thanksgiving. It was cold as blue blazes, and I went out on the campus and got on my knees, and I asked the Lord, I said, God, I don't want to go to another party. I want to get married. There was this drive. So within 2 weeks, my sister called me and said, Lanier, there's this girl in my Sunday school class I'd like for you to meet. And she said, you or your brother? I said, I'll be over in 2 weeks. And that was an answer to prayer. So when I went over in Christmas of 1965, she invited us down to dinner. So I was taking my two nieces down to their mother's, and we stopped at her house on the way. And I knocked at the door, and the foreign exchange student that the Oates had in their home met me at the door. And I said to myself, boy, if I can ever get hold of my sister, I'm gonna really get her for this one. And anyway, she stepped back and introduced me to Kathy, and wow, okay. So we were driving down to my sister's house, and my niece said, Uncle Near, are you going to marry her? Blind date. I said, we'll see. And immediately fear crept in and a lack of courage. Let's just punt this whole thing. We courted for a year and a half, went into the military together. She was disciple as well as me, and life has been wonderful. But that was the most fearsome. The result of my coming to Dallas is probably 3 or 4 members of my family have been saved. You shine even when you don't mean to. So that takes the burden off. Any regrets? Oh, I would say dozens. I would say dozens, but I don't pay any attention to failure or regret. Because I'll tell you something about myself. Having lived life, I am a rather radical imperfectionist. I mean, I'm just saying, I've seen so many people make so many mistakes. Wait a minute now, what's the doctrine of sin in the first place? We all make mistakes and we all fail, you know? And when you look at the recent elections, you realize that people won't admit failure. But I don't have any problem with failure. That's just an opportunity to grow. But that comes out of living. I mean, you can't go to a school and pick that up. But, you know, do I have regrets? I had regrets along the way that I discovered were not regrets. I wondered if I should come to Dallas Seminary, given the hostility of my family to coming. I was in line. There was an enormously gifted person in my class at the seminary. We were going to do team ministry together, which have required my going to Houston to be in ministry with him. But my son was here, and I was writing a doctoral dissertation here, and I couldn't leave. So, you know, I did live through regret, Ben. And it was not a regret. It was just what I had to do. And that's a product of my parents and my military. You know, you set your eyes like flint and you keep going forward. See? So when I finished my first doctorate, the dean of Dallas Seminary called me in and said, Lanier, we want you to go back to doctoral work. I said, well, do I get a job? He said, we'll give you a job, but you got to go back for a second doctorate. Why? Because a seminary needs a university doctorate on its faculty, right? I just finished a doctorate, so he said, I know, but we want you to get another one. Now, what are you going to do when you do that? When the dean, who's your boss, tells you to do it, military, upbringing, do it. And I did it. And my advisor at the University of Texas said, would you like to teach at Cambridge University in history? We would like for you to tutor the tutor at St. John's College. Would you like to do that? Well, that's a plum. I said, hey, how long do I have to think about that? What would you say? What would you say? Huh? Go ahead and be honest. Yeah! Yeah. He said, you got one day. Because there are thousands in England who would love that position. It was tutoring the tutors. But I had four kids in college, had to pay bills. I was chairman of the theology department. I had a full teaching load. Do I want to teach Jesus Christ or do I want to teach Henry VIII? And I made my decision for the Lord. And boy, that was not a regret, Ben. But every DTS alum who is my peer said, you ought to have taken it. Because that's a very prestigious thing to do, but prestige is worthless if the Lord's not in it. You see? And you're afraid the world will pass you by. That was a little academic aside. I didn't mean to bring that in. Okay? May the words of our mouth and the meditations of our heart be acceptable in thy sight as we have spent the full amount of time together. Pray that we can go from here and serve you and not be afraid of a world, because greater is he that is us than he that is in the world. Please give us courage to serve well. We love you, we need you, and all that we do. In Jesus' name,